When Julius Caesar approached the little river called the Rubicon in the winter of 49 BC, the distance before him was small and the meaning was enormous. A rider could cross it in moments. A column of marching men could reach the far bank almost as quickly. Yet that narrow line marked the edge of lawful command. On one side, Caesar stood as a Roman governor in his province with the right to command soldiers. On the other side lay Italy, the political heart of the Republic, where no magistrate was meant to arrive at the head of an army. Once he crossed with the 13th Legion, a struggle over law, status, and survival would harden into civil war. The boundary stood at the edge of a political system built on a deep fear of one-man rule. Romans told themselves that they had driven out their kings centuries earlier and had never allowed a crown to return. In place of a king, they had magistrates who held office for a limited term, senators who advised and debated, popular assemblies that elected officials and passed laws, and tribunes who could defend the interests of the plebeians. In theory, power was shared, temporary, and restrained by custom. No office was supposed to last forever. No citizen was supposed to tower so high above the state that he could bend it to his personal will. But the Roman Republic had grown far beyond the city-state that first shaped those habits. By the first century BC, Rome ruled a vast world stretching across the Mediterranean. Its armies served in Spain, Gaul, Greece, North Africa, and the eastern provinces. Conquest brought treasure, enslaved labor, tax revenues, and land, and all of that wealth poured back into Roman politics. Elections became expensive, patronage networks grew larger. Ambitious aristocrats borrowed staggering sums to fund public games, bribe voters, and advance their careers. A successful command abroad could raise a man above his rivals in a way no speech in the Senate ever could. Roman military command, what the Romans called imperium, carried real force. A consul or governor with imperium could lead armies, issue orders, punish disobedience, negotiate with allies, and wage war in the name of the Republic. Yet that power belonged in the provinces, at a careful distance from civic life in Italy. Generals fought Rome's enemies abroad, then laid down command before resuming political life at home. If that line failed, the Republic faced its oldest nightmare. The army that defended the state could become the weapon that mastered it. By Caesar's lifetime, Romans had already seen that nightmare with their own eyes. The generation before him had lived through political murder, street bloodshed, and the spectacle of Roman commanders using Roman soldiers against Roman citizens. Marius had shown how military success and personal following could transform politics. Sulla went further. He marched on Rome itself, seized power by force, and published lists of enemies who could be killed with legal protection. Those memories never faded. Every later statesman knew that the Republic still stood, but its rules now lived in the shadow of precedent set by armed men. The danger ran deeper than a few violent episodes. Roman public life had become fiercely competitive because so much rested on rank, reputation, and legal safety. Aristocrats competed for office in full view of the city. They measured themselves against their ancestors and against one another. Honor, victory, and dignity were public assets, and humiliation could be fatal. A failed politician might face prosecution, exile, financial ruin, or political extinction. That made compromise harder. Men did not simply seek office for prestige, they often sought it for protection. The Republic rewarded ambition at every stage, then grew alarmed when an ambitious man became too strong to contain. The Senate still carried prestige, and Romans continued to speak the language of law and custom, but public life had become rougher and less stable. Tribunes used the assemblies to challenge senatorial authority. Senators fought back with emergency decrees and procedural obstruction. Political gangs roamed the streets, trials became weapons. Popular leaders claimed to defend the people against oligarchic arrogance, while senatorial conservatives claimed to defend the Constitution against reckless demagogues. Each side could point to real abuses. Each side could present itself as the guardian of Rome. By the middle of the first century BC, the Republic still looked intact from a distance. Up close, trust had worn thin. Into that world stepped two men whose talents and ambitions made collision increasingly likely. Pompey the Great had built his name through astonishing military success while still a young man. He crushed enemies in Sicily and Africa, defeated pirates in the Mediterranean, and reshaped Rome's eastern settlements after campaigns in the east. He carried immense prestige, but prestige alone never guaranteed security in Roman politics. Julius Caesar came from an ancient patrician family that had more ancestry than ready cash. He possessed charm, daring, political intelligence, and an appetite for glory that matched any man of his generation. He needed great success, and he meant to have it. For a time, Pompey and Caesar found common cause, helped by the wealth of Marcus Crassus. Their bargain gave each of them room to advance, and it sent Caesar to Gaul with the sort of command that could transform a career. It did more than that. Year by year, victory in Gaul turned Caesar into something larger than an ordinary magistrate. He gained money, fame, hardened legions, and officers whose fortunes rose with his own. In Rome, men who feared domination looked at Caesar and saw the outline of another Sulla. Caesar, looking back toward Rome, saw enemies who meant to strip him of command and expose him to prosecution the moment he stood alone. The river itself was modest. The history behind it was not. When Caesar approached its banks, he carried with him the burdens of Roman expansion, the habits of aristocratic rivalry, the memory of earlier civil wars, and the rivalry that had grown between himself, Pompey, and the senatorial men gathering around Pompey. A shallow frontier stream became the line between political contest and open war. To follow Caesar across it, we first have to begin with the Republic that formed him, the Republic that raised Pompey, and the long chain of crises that taught Romans to fear the ambitions of their own greatest men. Part 1. A Republic Already Under Strain. The Republic that formed Caesar and Pompey was already carrying old fractures. Roman writers loved to describe their constitution as a balanced system, steady because it distributed authority among consuls, senate, assemblies, and tribunes. In practice, that balance depended on habit, restraint, and the willingness of aristocrats to lose gracefully from time to time. By the 2nd century BC, those habits were under pressure from success itself. Rome had defeated Carthage, humbled the kingdoms of the Eastern Mediterranean, and gathered an empire faster than its political system could comfortably absorb. Wealth flowed into Italy, but it flowed unevenly. Great families acquired more land, more clients, and more influence, while many small farmers found themselves displaced, indebted, or drawn away for long military service. Those tensions broke into the open with the brothers Tiberius and Gaius Gracchus. They were aristocrats themselves, but they tried to use the office of tribune to push land reform, weaken the grip of senatorial oligarchy, and answer the mounting anger of citizens who felt that the rewards of empire had bypassed them. Their proposals were controversial enough, their methods were even more so. They appealed over the heads of the Senate to the popular assemblies, and their enemies answered with violence. Tiberius was clubbed to death with many of his supporters. A decade later, Gaius met a similar end after street fighting and repression. Roman politics had always been competitive, but now murder had entered the center of public life as an accepted instrument. The Republic still functioned after the Gracchi, yet the terms of political struggle had changed. Reformers had learned that appealing to the people could shake the Senate. Senators had learned that force could settle disputes that procedure no longer contained. At the same time, Rome's military burdens kept growing. Campaigns stretched farther from home, and commanders spent longer periods abroad. That increased the prestige of successful generals and strengthened the bond between soldiers and the men who led them to victory. The old ideal had been a citizen army obedient to the state. The reality was moving toward armies that remembered the generosity, victories, and promises of particular commanders. No man showed that shift more clearly than Marius. He rose from the town of Arpinum rather than from the highest Roman nobility, built a formidable military reputation, and won extraordinary popularity through success in war. His victories against Jugurtha in North Africa and then against the Cimbri and Teutones made him the savior of Rome in the eyes of many citizens. He also became consul again and again, an extraordinary concentration of office that would have startled earlier generations. Later tradition often linked Marius with military reforms that opened the army more fully to poorer citizens. Whatever the exact administrative changes, the larger political truth is clear enough. Rome increasingly relied on long service, professional experience, and commanders who could reward their veterans with land and patronage. Military success now generated a political following of enormous power. The next crisis made the weakness of the system even clearer. Rome had long ruled over Italian allies who supplied troops and paid the costs of empire without receiving the full rights of Roman citizenship. They fought in Rome's wars, but they remained outside the political community that directed those wars. In the late 2nd century BC, demands for citizenship grew more urgent. When reform failed, much of Italy revolted in the conflict modern historians call the Social War. It was a hard and intimate struggle because Rome was fighting communities that looked, armed, and organized much like itself. The Republic eventually regained control, but it did so while also conceding what it had long resisted. Citizenship spread across much of Italy. The Roman state survived, yet it emerged larger, more militarized, and more politically complicated than before. Out of that violent decade came the most shocking precedent of all. Lucius Cornelius Sulla had first served under Marius, but rivalry, faction, and personal ambition drove them apart. When Sulla won command against Mithridates, Marius and his allies used political pressure to strip it from him. Sulla answered with an act that would have once seemed unthinkable. He marched Roman legions on Rome itself. Even after he departed for the east, the struggle continued, and when he returned victorious, he seized power on a still greater scale. His enemies were hunted down, property was confiscated, lists of the proscribed were posted in public, and men could enrich themselves by killing those named there. Terror became policy. Sulla called himself dictator to restore the Republic, and in one sense he truly did want to strengthen the old order. He curtailed the powers of the tribunes, tried to bolster the Senate, and imposed constitutional rules meant to prevent future upheaval. Yet his methods undermined the principles he claimed to defend. He had shown that a Roman commander could enter Italy with an army, settle political arguments by force, and then write laws after victory. Even his retirement could not erase that lesson. The precedent remained, and everybody understood it. Future statesmen might condemn Sulla, but they still learned from him. The men who came of age in the aftermath carried these lessons into every calculation. Ambition remained inseparable from fear. A politician who reached high office gained prestige and legal protection, but he also gained enemies. A general who won a province might return rich and admired, yet admiration could quickly become suspicion. Men clung to command because command offered safety. Rivals tried to cut those commands short because delay made a dangerous man even harder to control. In that environment, constitutional argument was never only about principle. It was also about survival, revenge, and the memory of what defeated enemies had suffered. Julius Caesar was born into that world in 100 BC, the same year traditional chronology places Marius at the height of his influence. He belonged to an old patrician house with famous ancestors but limited means, and his family connections leaned toward the Marian side of Roman politics. As a young man, he would watch the regime of Sulla demand submission from families like his. Caesar did not inherit a calm republic, disturbed by his own ambition. He inherited a republic whose rules had already been bent, bloodied, and repeatedly tested by men who claimed to act for the public good. By the time Caesar entered public life, Rome had already taught its greatest figures two dangerous lessons. Force could decide politics, and a man who laid down power too soon might lose far more than office. Part 2. Caesar before Gaul. If the Republic had already taught Rome to fear powerful generals, it had also taught ambitious young aristocrats that hesitation could leave them helpless. Julius Caesar learned that early. He was born in 100 BC into the Julian clan, one of the oldest patrician families in Rome, a house that traced its ancestry through legend to Aeneas and the goddess Venus. That pedigree carried prestige, but it did not guarantee wealth or security. Caesar's family stood high in rank, yet modestly in resources compared with the richest houses in Roman politics. Just as important, his relatives were tied to the Marian side of public life. His aunt Julia had married Marius. Caesar himself married Cornelia, the daughter of Cinna, another leading opponent of Sulla. In calmer times, those connections would have been useful. Under Sulla, they became dangerous. When Sulla emerged as master of Rome, he expected obedience, especially from young men with compromised loyalties. Caesar received an order to divorce Cornelia. He refused. Personal loyalty may have played a part, but so did stubbornness, pride, and a willingness to accept danger rather than bend too easily. Sulla stripped him of offices and inheritance expectations, and Caesar went into hiding for a time, moving from place to place until influential relatives and friends secured a pardon. Later tradition claimed that Sulla, after reluctantly sparing him, warned that many Mariuses lurked in this young man. Whether the exact words are authentic or polished by hindsight, the judgment fit. Even before he held major office, Caesar was already visible as someone with unusual appetite and unusual nerve. With Rome unsafe for him, Caesar pursued the sort of path open to an ambitious noble without a secure footing at home. He served in Asia Minor, where he began to build the military record expected of a Roman statesman. He earned distinction at the Siege of Mytilene and moved in the circles of provincial command, where men learned how power worked at a distance from the capital. He later traveled to Rhodes to study rhetoric, a sign of another side of his ambition. Roman politics was a spoken world. A man who wanted to rise needed to move a crowd, dominate a court, and carry a case in the Senate. Caesar wanted military glory, but he also wanted command of language, posture, and public impression. The pirate episode, at least as later writers told it, suited him perfectly. Sailing across the eastern Mediterranean, he was seized by Cilician pirates who demanded a ransom. Caesar reportedly treated the affair less like captivity than like an inconvenience. He joked with his captors, complained that they had asked too little for a man of his worth, and promised to punish them when he was free. After the ransom was paid, he raised ships, hunted the pirates down, and had them executed. Ancient writers kept the story because it matched the Caesar they wanted to remember. Audacious, theatrical, quick to turn humiliation into revenge, and utterly convinced of his own future greatness. Even if details were sharpened in retelling, the outline rings true. Caesar had begun to cultivate a style of leadership built on confidence so extreme that it could look like destiny. When he returned to Rome, he advanced through the ladder of public offices that structured aristocratic careers. He served as military tribune, then quaestor, and gradually became known as a gifted speaker and a generous patron. Yet advancement in Rome demanded money on a scale that even old families often lacked. Caesar solved that problem the way many ambitious nobles did, only on a grander scale. He borrowed. He staged lavish public games. He restored monuments. He dressed magnificently, entertained allies, and made himself impossible to ignore. By the time he held the aedileship, he had become one of the most talked about men in the city and one of the most indebted. Debt did not restrain him. It drove him forward. Success was no longer desirable for Caesar. It was necessary. He also showed a sharp instinct for public memory. During his political rise, he deliberately revived the image of Marius, whose legacy still divided Roman opinion. At family funerals and public ceremonies, he displayed ancestral masks and honors that reminded Romans of connections Sulla's regime had tried to bury. It was risky signaling. Voters and rivals alike could see that he would not build his future as a quiet servant of the Sullan order. He meant to inherit something larger. The support of the people, the grievances of men excluded from senatorial dominance, and the aura of a statesman bold enough to challenge entrenched power. His election as Pontifex Maximus in 63 BC confirmed how formidable he had become. The office of chief priest carried prestige, visibility, and an official residence in the center of Rome. Caesar won it against older and more established opponents, partly through relentless canvassing and partly through the network of obligations that years of borrowing and favor trading had helped him create. The victory announced that he was no longer merely promising talent. He was now a central figure in Roman public life, yet prestige brought greater scrutiny. Caesar's enemies watched his debts, mocked his extravagance, and distrusted his populist instincts. Friends admired his brilliance, but even friends knew that brilliance without a secure power base could end badly in Rome. The same pattern marked his praetorship and the governorship that followed in further Spain. In Spain, Caesar at last gained what city politics alone could not provide: independent command, military action, and the chance to enrich both himself and his followers. He campaigned successfully against local tribes, settled administrative business, and returned with enough money and reputation to transform his immediate prospects. Ancient biographers also preserved a story from Spain in which Caesar, seeing a statue of Alexander the Great, lamented how little he had achieved at a similar age. The anecdote may be polished, but once again, it expresses something essential. Caesar measured himself against the largest available standard. Ordinary success never looked sufficient to him. By the time he came back from Spain, Caesar had accumulated nearly everything an ambitious Roman could desire except safety. He had lineage, eloquence, boldness, priestly prestige, a following among the people, and now military credibility. He also had towering debts, resentful rivals, and a rank just short of the supreme offices that could protect and elevate him. A man like Caesar could not retire into comfort. He had moved too far, spent too much, and frightened too many people. To win the consulship and secure a command worthy of his ambition, he needed allies stronger than friendship alone. He needed men who could match the Senate's resistance with wealth, soldiers, and influence of their own. Part 3. Pompey, Crassus, and the Bargain That Changed Rome. Caesar now needed powerful partners, and there were only two men in Rome who could truly change his position. One was Pompey the Great, the most celebrated commander of his age. The other was Marcus Crassus, the richest politician in the Republic and one of the shrewdest. They distrusted each other, and for good reason. Pompey possessed glory, veterans, and prestige so dazzling that it could unsettle the whole political class. Crassus possessed money, clients, and the relentless instinct for turning influence into advantage. Caesar's gift was different. He could read men, bridge rival camps when it served him, and make himself indispensable to people who otherwise had little desire to cooperate. Pompey had risen with startling speed during the age of Sulla. Still young, and without having held the full sequence of offices expected of a Roman statesman, he had raised troops from his family's base in Picenum and attached himself to Sulla's cause. His early victories in Sicily and Africa won him the sort of glory that usually belonged to older men. Sulla reportedly gave him the title The Great. Whether intended in admiration, irony, or a mixture of both, the name stuck. Pompey cultivated it carefully. He had the bearing of a man conscious of his stature, and he expected the Senate to recognize the scale of his achievements even when his career broke normal rules. Those achievements only multiplied. He helped suppress the remnants of revolt in Spain, played a role in ending the Spartacus rebellion after Crassus had done the hardest fighting, and then received extraordinary command against piracy in the Mediterranean. That campaign made him seem uniquely effective. In a matter of months, he cleared the sea lanes on which Rome's grain supply depended. He then turned east, defeated Mithridates, reorganized territories, settled client kings, and returned with a reputation that no Roman of his generation could match. Yet Pompey's greatness also created political frustration. He needed land for his veterans and ratification for his eastern settlements, and the Senate's leading conservatives often met him with delay, jealousy, or obstruction. A man who had conquered abroad found that Rome remained difficult to master. Crassus had followed a very different road to the summit. He came from a noble family, survived the Marian period by leaving Rome, and returned under Sulla, where he made part of his immense fortune in the brutal world that followed civil war. Crassus understood property, debt, speculation, and the political uses of wealth better than almost anyone alive. He was famous for his riches, but money alone does not explain his importance. He financed careers, supported networks of dependents, and understood how to convert private obligation into public leverage. He also wanted honor equal to his wealth. The trouble was that Rome admired conquest more than account books. Crassus could buy influence, but he could not easily buy the aura of a Pompey. The rivalry between the two men sharpened after the war against Spartacus. Crassus had done the main work of defeating the slave army, but Pompey returned in time to claim a share of the credit. They served as consuls together in 70 BC, outwardly reconciled and inwardly suspicious. Each had something the other lacked. Pompey commanded the loyalty of soldiers and the affection of the public. Crassus commanded money on a scale that could transform careers and sway voting blocks. Each also knew that the other could become dangerous if left unchecked. That was the political landscape Caesar entered as he aimed for the consulship. He solved the problem by doing what few Romans could do convincingly. He made the two rivals work together. Modern historians call the arrangement the First Triumvirate, though it was never an official office or lawful board. It was a private bargain among men who together could overwhelm ordinary resistance. Pompey wanted his eastern acts confirmed and land allotted to his veterans. Crassus wanted relief for tax contractors in Asia and a stronger position against senatorial enemies. Caesar wanted the consulship and, beyond it, a command large enough to secure his future. Each man could help the other two get what the Senate had made difficult. The alliance was strengthened not only by interest but by family connection. Pompey married Caesar's daughter Julia, a match that helped turn political calculation into something more personal. A decade earlier, such a connection would have seemed improbable given their different ages, reputations, and political paths. By the late 50s BC, it became one of the emotional ligaments holding the alliance together. For the moment, though, the immediate business was power. Caesar won the consulship for 59 BC, and his year in office showed exactly how far he was willing to go when traditional methods stood in his way. His colleague, Marcus Bibulus, tried to obstruct legislation through delay, religious maneuvers, and appeals to constitutional forms. Caesar answered with pressure from the assemblies, support from Pompey's veterans, and the hard edge of organized public force. Laws were passed. Pompey got land for his soldiers. Crassus got his concession for the tax interests. Caesar, in return, secured what he had wanted all along. By popular vote, he received a substantial provincial command in Cisalpine Gaul and Illyricum, soon enlarged to include Transalpine Gaul. More important than the map was the duration. This was not a short assignment. It was a command long enough to build an army, accumulate wealth, and create a political machine at a safe distance from Rome. The bargain linked three different forms of power that had previously pulled against one another. Caesar brought energy, popular appeal, and legislative aggression. Pompey brought military prestige and the authority of a national hero. Crassus brought money, contacts, and the ability to lubricate the machinery of Roman politics. Together, they did not abolish the constitution. They bent it. Senators still met. Magistrates still held office. Assemblies still voted. Yet a new reality had emerged behind the old forms. Rome's public life now turned increasingly on negotiations among men whose private power could override institutional resistance. Caesar had entered the alliance as a brilliant but vulnerable politician with debts at his back and enemies in front of him. He left Rome for Gaul with legal command, political cover, and the chance to win the kind of victories that could place him beyond ordinary comparison. Rome had given Caesar what he needed. Now Gaul would allow him to turn that opening into something far larger and far more difficult for the Republic to absorb. Part 4. Gaul and the making of Caesar's power. Gaul gave Caesar what city politics alone never could. In Rome, even a gifted and ruthless man had to struggle day by day through elections, lawsuits, alliances, and obstruction. In Gaul, he held imperium over armies in the field, far from constant interference by rivals. The command began with real strategic concerns on Rome's northern frontier, but it quickly became something more. Caesar saw opportunity in every disturbance. If tribes were migrating, he could present himself as the defender of Roman allies. If German forces crossed the Rhine, he could cast himself as the shield of Italy against a wider danger. Each campaign strengthened his legal position, enriched his followers, and increased his fame at home. The first years of the war established the pattern. Caesar moved against migrating tribes in central Gaul, then turned against German forces and northern tribal coalitions that had once seemed beyond Rome's easy reach. These were hard, mobile campaigns that demanded speed, logistics, and nerve as much as open battle. Caesar showed a flair for rapid marches, surprise, and political manipulation among rival tribal groups. He was willing to negotiate when it served him and utterly ruthless when it did not. The result was a growing sense, among Romans and Gauls alike, that Caesar was no ordinary governor finishing out a term. He was building a new sphere of power. Military victory brought practical rewards as well as reputation. Successful campaigns produced booty, slaves, tribute, and access to the sort of wealth that could rescue a heavily indebted politician. They also gave Caesar soldiers whose fortunes were tied directly to his own. Roman legions swore obedience to the state, but in practice they marched for the commander who fed them, rewarded them, praised them in dispatches, and led them to victory. Caesar understood morale. He knew the value of speed and rewarding courage, the value of shared hardship, and the value of appearing calm when others panicked. He addressed his troops personally, remembered units and centurions, and gave them reasons to believe that their glory and his were inseparable. The bond entered his legend. The 13th Legion would later be the unit most closely associated with the Rubicon, but Caesar's wider army culture mattered just as much. Campaign after campaign, his men built roads, stormed hill forts, threw bridges across difficult ground, and survived winters in hostile country. They learned that he asked a great deal and often delivered more. He exposed them to danger, yet he also shared in hardship and made certain Rome heard of their achievements. In an aristocratic world where status depended on recognition, Caesar distributed recognition expertly. A centurion's courage, a legion's steadiness, a difficult engineering feat, a forced march through bad weather, all could become part of a larger story in which the army saw itself as exceptional. Caesar also mastered the political value of writing. His commentaries on the Gallic War were not detached history. They were elegant acts of self-presentation, sent back to Rome in language that made his campaigns seem necessary, rational, and repeatedly successful against dangerous enemies. He wrote about himself in the third person, a stylistic choice that gave the narrative an air of cool objectivity even when it served his interests at every turn. Readers in Rome encountered a Caesar who was tireless, disciplined, measured, and unfailingly effective. They also encountered Gaul as a theatre of constant threat and Roman victory. Caesar was absent from the capital for years at a time. His books and dispatches allowed him to remain politically present even while campaigning at the edge of the known world. Some of his most celebrated acts were designed as much for impression as for immediate strategic gain. He bridged the Rhine, demonstrating that Rome could carry war across the boundary that many regarded as a natural limit. He crossed to Britain twice, not to annex the island permanently, but to prove range, audacity, and command of the narrative. These expeditions advertised a general who refused ordinary limits. Each exploit enlarged his fame. They also fed a dangerous contrast. While many senators in Rome were trapped in procedural wrangling and urban faction, Caesar appeared as a man of decision, action, and results. Yet conquest in Gaul was neither clean nor effortless. Resistance persisted, and Roman severity deepened hatred. Harsh reprisals, sieges, hostage-taking, and mass enslavement helped keep the war moving in Caesar's favor, but they also ensured that opposition would return. The great test came in 52 BC, when a broad uprising rallied around Vercingetorix, a Gallic nobleman who briefly achieved what many thought impossible. He united a large part of Gaul against Rome. Caesar now faced the kind of coordinated resistance that could have ruined a lesser commander and, with him, the whole political project tied to his command. The campaign that followed brought Caesar to Alesia. After setbacks and brutal maneuvering, he trapped Vercingetorix there and built one ring of fortifications to hold the defenders in and another to keep relieving forces out. It was a feat of engineering, discipline, and endurance on a vast scale. When the Roman lines held and the relief army failed, Vercingetorix surrendered and organized Gallic resistance collapsed. Alesia did not instantly pacify every district, but after it, few Romans could doubt the scale of Caesar's achievement. He had conquered an immense region, broken a formidable coalition, and done so with methods that seemed to confirm every claim his supporters made for him. The success transformed politics in Rome. Caesar now possessed enormous war spoils, veteran troops hardened by nearly a decade of campaigning, and a reputation that reached far beyond his formal office. Young, ambitious men were drawn to him because service under Caesar could launch a career. Creditors tolerated his debts because victory promised repayment. Supporters in the assemblies could point to visible achievements rather than abstract promises. His enemies saw the same facts and drew the opposite conclusion. If Caesar returned at the head of this prestige, with soldiers devoted to him and clients financed by Gallic wealth, he might dominate the Republic beyond recall. And while Caesar grew stronger in the north, the alliance that had shielded him at home began to weaken. Julia, whose marriage had helped link Caesar and Pompey, died in 54 BC. Crassus, still seeking military glory worthy of his fortune, marched east and was killed by the Parthians at Carrhae in 53 BC. With Julia gone and Crassus dead, the personal and political bonds that had held the partnership together were suddenly thinner. Caesar still commanded Gaul. Pompey still stood in Rome with immense dignity and influence. But the space between them had widened, and many senators were ready to use that widening gap. Gaul had made Caesar great. It had also made the future far more dangerous. Part 5. Rome without Caesar. While Caesar was remaking himself in Gaul, Rome was drifting into a different kind of crisis. The city remained noisy, rich, ceremonial, and crowded with office seekers, but beneath the rituals, public trust kept decaying. The alliance that had stabilized politics for a few years was losing the personal ties that had made it workable. Julia's death in 54 BC meant more than family grief. She had been Caesar's daughter and Pompey's wife, a human bridge between two ambitious men whose interests were beginning to diverge. Her death loosened that bond at exactly the moment when both men most needed reasons for patience. Crassus's death the following year made the shift sharper. He had marched east in search of military glory equal to his wealth and returned in disgrace only as a corpse. At Carrhae, the Parthians destroyed his army and killed him in one of the great Roman disasters of the age. With Crassus gone, the triangular balance vanished. There were no longer three great men checking and bargaining with one another. There were two, and each stood in a very different political landscape. Caesar remained far away with an army. Pompey remained close to Rome, the Senate, and the administrative machinery of the state. Pompey's incentives changed with it. He had once needed Caesar as a partner against senatorial obstruction. Now, many senators who had long distrusted Pompey began to see him as the lesser danger and the necessary counterweight to Caesar. Pompey, for his part, still carried the prestige of past victories, and he still wanted dignity, recognition, and influence within the political order. He did not need to imitate Caesar's rise through conquest, because he had already achieved something similar in his own way. What he increasingly needed was to preserve his standing in Rome while ensuring that Caesar did not return from Gaul with enough strength to eclipse him. The conditions inside the capital pushed him further in that direction. Roman politics had grown rough for decades, but in the 50s BC it became openly violent. Clodius built a mass following, wielded the tribunate as a weapon, and kept gangs in the streets. His enemy Milo organized rival gangs backed by conservative interests. Elections became disorderly, trials became political theater under threat of force, public meetings could turn into brawls. The city that claimed to govern the Mediterranean world increasingly struggled to govern itself. The crisis peaked in 52 BC when Clodius was killed in a confrontation on the Appian Way. His supporters carried the body into Rome, fury erupted, and the Senate House itself was burned in the chaos. Urban scandal had spilled into something larger. The Republic's ordinary processes looked fragile under pressure from faction and private violence. In response, Pompey was made sole consul, an extraordinary appointment that showed both his stature and the weakness of the system around him. Romans still spoke in constitutional language, but once again, an emergency had elevated one man above the normal rhythm of office because the normal rhythm no longer seemed sufficient. The appointment placed personal authority above institutional confidence. In healthier times, aristocrats prided themselves on collegial office, annual terms, and shared restraint. Now many of them looked to Pompey's name as a substitute for confidence in the system itself. He was expected to steady elections, calm the streets, and reassure frightened elites simply by standing above the disorder. That expectation flattered Pompey, but it also deepened the habit of solving constitutional weakness by leaning on exceptional men. Pompey used that moment to restore a degree of order, but order came with political consequences. He stood closer to the senatorial establishment than he had during the height of his alliance with Caesar. He married Cornelia, linking himself to a powerful conservative family circle around Scipio. He passed laws on bribery and violence and positioned himself as a guardian of public stability. None of this made him a simple puppet of the Senate. Pompey remained proud, independent, and keenly aware of his own authority, but it did mean that more and more men around him now imagined a future in which Pompey and the Senate together could contain Caesar. That future looked dangerous to Caesar. His command in Gaul still protected him, but commands ended. Once he returned to Rome as a private citizen, stripped of imperium, he would become vulnerable to prosecution by enemies who had been watching him grow stronger for years. Charges could be framed around violence in his consulship, irregularities in legislation, or abuses in provincial command. In Roman politics, a prosecution did not simply threaten reputation. It threatened property, status, and the ability to continue in public life at all. Caesar had too much to lose and too many foes to trust vague assurances. The problem was psychological as well as legal. Caesar had spent nearly a decade commanding armies, winning victories, and receiving the sort of deference that triumph naturally creates. Back in Rome, his rivals would expect him to dismiss troops, submit to procedure, and accept whatever timetable the political class chose to impose. That might have suited an ordinary governor. Caesar had ceased to be ordinary long ago. At the same time, Pompey had spent those same years becoming the man whose authority in Italy seemed most capable of anchoring the state. Each man, therefore, occupied a role that the other could not easily ignore. Caesar represented military greatness in the provinces. Pompey represented public order at the center. As this distance widened, so did suspicion. Senators hostile to Caesar encouraged Pompey to see him as an approaching threat. Caesar's supporters encouraged him to see every move in Rome as the opening phase of a trap. Letters, envoys, family connections, and old friendship still offered channels of communication, but the atmosphere around those channels kept worsening. The Republic had become a place where nearly every concession looked like weakness, and every delay looked strategic. Even before the legal crisis fully matured, both camps had started to imagine the worst. A routine political transition now looked increasingly unlikely. In a healthier republic, Caesar might have returned from Gaul, sought another consulship, and continued his rivalry with Pompey through elections, speeches, and negotiation. By the end of the 50s BC, few leading Romans still trusted that kind of outcome. Caesar feared humiliation and prosecution if he laid down command first. Pompey and his senatorial allies feared domination if Caesar retained command too long. Rome without Caesar had not become calmer in his absence. It had become more brittle, more suspicious, and more dependent on strong men. Tension was obvious. Whether the Republic still had a peaceful way to contain it was less clear. Part 6. The Legal War, Before the Real One. By the end of the 50s BC, the struggle between Caesar and his enemies was still being fought in the language of law. Both sides were still fighting for Roman opinion. No one wished to appear as the open destroyer of the Republic before events forced the mask aside. Caesar insisted that he was defending his lawful rights. Pompey and many senators insisted that they were defending the state against intimidation. Each position had enough truth in it to persuade supporters and enough calculation in it to harden the dispute. At the center of the argument stood a practical question with enormous consequences. When Caesar's command in Gaul expired, could he stand for the consulship while away from Rome, or must he first return as a private citizen? If Caesar could stand while still under command, then he could move directly from provincial imperium to new office without exposing himself. If he had to come home first, lay down command, and wait, then his enemies would have a window in which to prosecute, humiliate, or politically cripple him. Caesar therefore pressed for the right to seek the consulship without surrendering that protection first. His opponents treated that demand as a way of preserving exceptional power. The practical details were inseparable from Roman ideas of honor. A candidate for high office ordinarily appeared in person, canvassed for votes, greeted supporters, and displayed his standing before the city. Caesar was asking for an exception because his circumstances were exceptional. He did not want to enter Rome merely as a private noble hoping for favor. He wanted to move from command to candidacy without a break in status. That would protect him legally and preserve his dignity. In Rome, a man who accepted humiliation invited more of it. To his enemies, that same insistence on dignity looked like a refusal to submit to the same rules that governed everyone else. The Senate had been debating versions of this problem for years. Motions were proposed to replace Caesar in Gaul. Tribunes friendly to him blocked some of them. Other senators argued that Pompey should also give up his command if Caesar was expected to do the same. Caesar's camp built its fairness argument around that point. If both men laid down power together, neither could exploit the other's vulnerability. That position was taken up most effectively by Gaius Curio, a gifted and restless politician who had drifted toward Caesar's side. Curio proposed that both Caesar and Pompey surrender their commands simultaneously. The idea had broad appeal because it sounded balanced, and because many senators privately feared both men rather than only one of them. For a moment, compromise seemed possible. In December of 50 BC, the Senate voted overwhelmingly in favor of the principle that both men should lay down command. Many Romans still wanted a legal settlement, yet compromise immediately ran into the problem that had poisoned the Republic for years. Nobody trusted the other side to carry it out honestly. Pompey's allies maneuvered to strengthen his military position in Italy. Caesar's supporters suspected that any delay or ambiguity would be turned against him. Resolutions passed in principle could still be smothered in procedure, reinterpreted by rivals, or overtaken by emergency moves outside the chamber. Pompey himself sat at the center of this uncertainty. He claimed readiness for lawful settlement, but he also acted from a position of gathering strength. Troops were available in Italy. His prestige remained immense. Many senators believed that if Caesar were pressed firmly enough, his coalition would break and his soldiers would disperse. Pompey seems to have shared some of that confidence. He had once said, or was said to have said, that he only needed to stamp his foot in Italy and legions would rise from the ground. Whether he spoke the words exactly that way matters less than the attitude behind them. Pompey believed that Caesar could be isolated if the state showed resolve. Caesar saw the same situation from the opposite angle. He had spent years winning victory, rewarding followers, and broadcasting his achievements to Rome. He believed that his enemies wanted more than constitutional regularity. They wanted revenge. If he yielded first, he would stand alone before men who despised his methods, resented his success, and had every incentive to make an example of him. His letters and proposals therefore combined conciliation with firmness. He repeatedly suggested that both he and Pompey give up command together. He could present this as moderation. His enemies could present it as blackmail backed by legions. As the new year approached, the atmosphere thickened. One of the consuls, Marcellus, pushed hard against Caesar and favored decisive action. Caesar sent a message to the Senate on the first day of January in 49 BC, again proposing terms that would avoid open conflict while preserving his dignity. They were rejected. Debate shifted toward coercion. The Senate was no longer arguing only about legal timing. It was deciding whether Caesar would be handled as a magistrate with claims or as a danger that had to be ordered into submission. At this stage, the tribunes became crucial. Mark Antony and Quintus Cassius Longinus, both aligned with Caesar, tried to use their office to block hostile measures. In the Roman system, tribunes were sacrosanct representatives of the plebeians, and interfering with them carried grave constitutional meaning. When the Senate and the anti-Caesarian leadership pressed ahead regardless, Antony and Cassius fled Rome and made their way to Caesar. Their flight became potent propaganda. Caesar could now say that lawful tribunes had been driven from the city by men who claimed to defend the Constitution. The decisive step came when the Senate issued what Romans called a final emergency decree. In effect, it told magistrates to see that the state suffered no harm. It was not a formal declaration of war, but it gave political cover for exceptional action. Supporters of the decree could argue that the Republic faced a threat so serious that ordinary protections had to give way. Opponents could argue that the measure was itself proof that the Constitution had been bent in order to crush one man before he could defend himself. Even at the brink, both sides still dressed their moves in constitutional clothing. The emergency decree sounded lawful. It also signaled that the struggle had entered a new phase. At Ravenna, the meaning was unmistakable. The tribunes had reached him. Negotiation had narrowed almost to nothing. The state had armed itself politically against him while leaving Pompey's position intact. He was now close to the frontier of Italy, with the 13th Legion near at hand and other forces farther away. Behind him stood years of conquest, debt, ambition, and fear. Ahead lay the choice that Roman statesmen had dreaded ever since Sulla: submit and trust enemies who had given him every reason for suspicion, or carry an army across the boundary that was supposed to protect the Republic from exactly this kind of decision. Thank you. Part 7. The Rubicon. By the time Caesar reached the Rubicon, the decision before him had narrowed almost to a single point. The Senate had armed itself with emergency powers. The tribunes who supported him had fled to his camp. Pompey stood backed by much of the political establishment. Caesar still had choices in theory, but each peaceful option now required him to trust men he believed were preparing his ruin. In early January of 49 BC, with the 13th Legion at hand, he moved toward the small river that marked the boundary between his provincial command and Italy. The Rubicon was not a grand natural barrier. It was a modest stream in the coastal plain of northeastern Italy. Its importance came from law and custom, not geography. South of it lay Italy proper, where a magistrate was not supposed to exercise provincial military command. North of it, Caesar remained a governor with imperium. South of it, if he crossed with troops, he became something far more dangerous in Roman eyes, a commander bringing armed force into the political heart of the Republic. A small stream entered history, its waters were ordinary, the act of crossing them was not. Romans had long depended on this distinction, even when they rarely stopped to think about it. Governors fought abroad, then returned as private citizens before resuming civic life. Triumphs, elections, and court cases all assumed some separation between military force and political debate inside Italy. That separation had been strained before, but it remained one of the Republic's core protections. Caesar was therefore breaking more than a technical rule. He was breaking the barrier that allowed Romans to believe that law still governed the center of their world. Ancient writers later surrounded the moment with dramatic detail. They described hesitation, omens, a sudden hardening of resolve, and the famous declaration that the die was cast. The fine details are hard to pin down with certainty because later authors had every reason to shape the scene into something memorable. Whatever the exact staging, Caesar understood perfectly well that this was the step Romans had feared ever since Sulla. Once taken, it would be almost impossible to undo. Caesar did not cross with a massive army. At the first moment, he had one legion immediately with him, not the whole weight of his provincial forces. This was a gamble in speed, nerve, and political shock. He was betting that the psychological effect of swift action would matter as much as raw numbers. A general who moved decisively could force enemies into retreat before they had time to gather strength. A general who hesitated might lose the initiative, and with it, the whole struggle. Caesar had built his career on acting faster than his opponents expected. The crossing of the Rubicon followed that same pattern. He crossed and moved quickly on Ariminum, the first significant town south of the boundary. The town opened a route deeper into Italy and showed that the crossing was already an accomplished fact. Debate in Rome could continue if men wish, but events were now moving with soldiers' feet. Caesar also framed his action carefully. He presented himself as the defender of the tribunes, the protector of his standing, and the man driven to arms by the unlawful aggression of his enemies. He was invading Italy, but he wanted Italians to hear not the language of conquest, but the language of redress. Force came with justification, as it often did with Caesar. He rarely acted without also shaping the explanation. His enemies saw transparent coercion backed by legions. His supporters could answer that he had been denied fair treatment and that the constitutional order had already been damaged by those who forced the tribunes to flee. Many Romans probably felt both reactions at once. They understood that Caesar had crossed a forbidden line. They also understood that the Republic had been drifting toward this kind of collision for years. The order was sudden. The conditions behind it had been forming for generations. Sulla had shown that armies could enter Italy. Caesar now showed that a Roman statesman could still believe such an act defensible if he convinced himself that the law had already been twisted against him. A shallow river, a marching legion, and a republic crossing from argument into civil war fixed the Rubicon in memory. Part 8. Panic in Italy and the Point of No Return. The immediate effect of the crossing was confusion out of proportion to the number of troops Caesar first brought into Italy. Panic spread through rumor, speed, and uncertainty. Politicians in Rome had spent months talking about law, procedure, and constitutional principle. Now, an army was on the move. Caesar advanced faster than many expected, and the political class reacted with the same weakness it had so often shown in theory. There was no unified plan, no settled confidence, and no deep reservoir of trust. Men who had spoken firmly in the Senate suddenly had to decide whether they were prepared to fight. Pompey still possessed the larger strategic position. He had influence across the Roman world, access to more troops in the long run, and the prestige to command a broad coalition. Yet the first phase of the crisis exposed a serious miscalculation. He and many of his supporters seemed to have believed that Caesar's boldness would isolate him, that Italy would rally at once to the Senate, and that Caesar's forces would look thin once the test came. Instead, cities opened their gates, local resistance remained weak, and the pace of events favored the man already in motion. Pompey chose not to stake everything on a hurried defense of Rome. He withdrew southward, and many senators withdrew with him. The withdrawal carried enormous symbolic cost. Rome was the center of the Republic, and abandoning it looked grave even if it made military sense. Caesar could now present himself as the man entering the capital's orbit while his enemies fled before him. He made the most of that advantage. He claimed that he had taken up arms to defend the tribunes, protect his standing, and resist a faction that had twisted the constitution for partisan ends. The message blended argument with reality. Caesar had indeed been squeezed by hostile politics. He had also chosen to answer that pressure with armed force. Italians watching events unfold had to interpret both truths at once. Caesar also used restraint where he thought it useful. He cultivated a reputation for clemency, or at least for selective moderation, because clemency could break enemy morale more effectively than indiscriminate terror. If towns submitted, they could hope for reasonable treatment. If senators hesitated, they could imagine a path back into favor. This posture contrasted sharply with the memory of Sulla's prescriptions. It cast Caesar as firm but not savage, decisive but not chaotic. Even his moderation, however, underscored the new reality. The fate of communities and aristocrats now depended on the choices of a commander in the field. Military alarm was only part of the damage. Confidence had collapsed. The institution still existed. Consuls still held titles. The Senate still met when it could. Laws and decrees were still issued. But the old assumption that political disputes would remain inside political channels had given way. Once Caesar crossed and Pompey answered by abandoning Rome to regroup for a larger war, the center of gravity shifted decisively away from civic process and toward armed power. Later generations heard that shift in the phrase crossing the Rubicon. The phrase came to mean more than taking a risk. It marked the point beyond which ordinary reversal no longer seemed possible. The civil war itself was only beginning. There would be more campaigns, more negotiations, more battles, more acts of mercy and brutality, and eventually the rise of Caesar as dictator. Yet the symbolic force of the Rubicon does not depend on what happened later at Pharsalus or in the final collapse of the old order. It depends on what the crossing revealed in that moment. The Republic had become so dependent on the rivalry of extraordinary men and so weakened in its habits of trust and restraint that a constitutional dispute could turn into an armed march on Italy within days. So the Little River became immortal. Caesar crossed it because he believed surrender meant destruction. Pompey yielded ground because he believed time and wider resources would save the state. Senators followed one side or the other because each feared domination by the other camp. Everyone still spoke of the Republic. Fewer and fewer people could protect it. The crossing exposed a truth that had been forming for generations. Rome still possessed laws, offices, and ancient prestige, but when those things collided with the ambitions and fears of men like Caesar and Pompey, they no longer held the final authority. This podcast was entirely produced by Andrew Scott. If you have any suggestions for topics or improvements, please get in contact.